Well, thanks very much for the invitation. As Mary said, I want to talk about materials modeling, specifically solids. And so part of this is a joint work with PhD Stephen Wang. This is a big thing. Jianping Liu and another collaborator at the Chinese Academy of Science. Okay, so I'll be talking about solids specifically. And so first let me set up the problem. The solids problem is the following. You have a material which is a piece of solid. This is, say, the undeformed configuration where no force is applied. And then you apply some force. And then deforms to a different position. So then the problem is to find out, given the force, what is this deformed position? Typically, the way we do it is that we use the coordinates of the undeformed configuration, which is called reference configuration, and that's also called Lagrangian coordinates. So the y would be the position after the deformation, so that would be the Eulerian, and u would be the displacement. So this is the problem. Of course, we want to solve this problem, we want to find some differential equations to solve. And the question is whether there is a differential equation that we're supposed to solve and get the deformed configuration. And the analog question, in the case of fluids, we know that all you have to do is to solve the Navier-Stokes equation. In fact, you barely need to know anything about the fluids. If you know how to analyze Navier-Stokes, you understand fluids equally well. So is this a situation solids? Probably not, because otherwise you would know there's another equation, somebody's name attached, that would be the equation for solids. Indeed, if you look into the books in solids, there will be many different equations. For example, in linear elasticity, this is called Navier equation. Linear and isotropic, exactly, yeah. And this will be nonlinear elasticity, the static case. And there are many other cases, like tons of equations for plasticity, thermal elasticity, et cetera, et cetera. So there's no universal equations that we're supposed to solve. It's continuum models for solid. And this is natural because when you think about solids, you really have to think about solids at different scales. For example, this is bad. What did I do?
Change source.
Change source.
Actually, this is the idea why we should not use it as a pointer, because always somebody presses the wrong button.
I don't see a change source here.
Well, I can tell what the kind of going on.
It's a tricky pointer. Okay, good. I'm not sure I need to do this anymore. Anyway, so what do we just...
Use another stick,
okay. There's actually a big, huge one, I don't know. That's the other extreme. This is okay? So civilized enough? So what I just described is sort of the continuum theory. That's what I was alluding to. But oftentimes you really need to think about the solids at an atomistic and even electronic level. So this is the message I want to convey. And this is quite different from fluids. In fluids, you know, most people never worry about what the molecules and atoms are doing in fluids. But in solids, it's not the case. Yeah, but once you know, right. Yeah, once you know these parameters, which are not many, you know, equation of state, but then you can pretty much done. That's it.
There's only silly people who work on the Boltzmann equation.
Pardon me?
I said there's only silly people who work on the Boltzmann equation.
Yeah, Boltzmann, that's true. Boltzmann, right. In some sense, it's already a non-standard situation with fluids, right, when you really have to use Boltzmann. You know, in usual case, when you know, like water or something, you know, gas. Usually you don't have to worry too much about what the atoms are doing. Now in solids, this is much, it's a rather different story, and... Certainly there are cases for which you need to solve boson. There are cases you need to think about atoms and molecules also. You know, for example, we studied polymer fluids. You definitely have to think about what the molecules are doing, right? But what I'm saying is that ordinary fluids, it's okay. Maybe that's a bad point to make. At least the point being that this, for solids, the atomistic picture is much more relevant. Okay, so what are the kind of atomistic models we're talking about? So the Bailey model would be that, you know, if you give the position of the atoms, you need to find the energy of the system. So the simplest model would be like these pairwise interactions. So R is the position of the atoms. Suppose we have N atoms. So the energy would be pairwise due to pairwise interaction. And this is a very familiar model called Lennard-Jones, the 12-6 model. This is a terrible model for solids, turns out. But there are more sophisticated models, Stillinger-Weber, embedded atoms. So these are kind of models that which would be called classical atomistic models. So you give the position of the atoms, we calculate the energy according to these kind of models. Once this model is given, then from this model, what can we get? The simplest thing we need to get out of this model is the crystal lattice. So we know solids at the smallest scale is a crystal lattice. And different solids exist in different crystal lattice, different crystals. So for example, this is a cubic. And that's supposed to be a BCC, body-centered cubic, but I think it's actually still a cubic. And this is FCC. This is a face-centered cubic. If you take a standard cubic lattice, on each face, in the middle of the face, you put another extra atom. So this is called face-centered cubic. This is also how you pack oranges. This is a closed packing lattice. So a closed structure, and then this is a diamond lattice, which is a so-called open structure. So if you're given these atomistic models, we should be able to find out what is the lattice that would be the minimizer of that atomistic model. In addition to that, of course, the solids we have are rarely, never, almost never, perfect lattices. They have all kinds of defects. For example, this is a picture of a dislocation. So what is dislocation? So this is a two-dimensional cartoon. You had a regular two-dimensional lattice, and then we insert an extra line of atoms. Really, it's extra plane, half plane of atoms, because there's a third direction coming up. So then you have this point here, which is a defect, actually a line, and that's called a dislocation. So there are all kinds of defects. Zero-dimensional defects would be like vacancies. You take some atoms away. Interstitials, if you add some extra atoms, this dislocation is a one-dimensional defect, and that's perhaps the most important defect in solids. Controls, for example, things like plasticity. Two-dimensional defects like grain boundaries, maybe that's what McPherson talked about. Plane boundaries and stuff like that. So out of these, the atomistic model, all these information in principle come out. Okay? Now, electronic structure model at the level of electrons, I'll postpone that to later. But let me now say that suppose we're dealing with these models, what questions do we need to address? What kind of things we want to understand of it? I already said the lattice, the so-called crystallization problem. Namely, given the model, the atomistic model, what is the ground state, the global minimizer of that model, which is supposed to be a lattice? And this is a non-trivial problem, perhaps the most non-trivial problem in this whole business. And this is the periodic table, and it's color-coded by my little daughter. And then, so the blue colors, these are called elemental solids. So solids made up of one kind of atoms only. So these blue colors are BCC, body-centered cubic. You take the cubic lattice, in the middle of each cube, you put an extra atom. So this is body-centered cubic. So these guys are body-centered cubic. And then on this side, we have the red ones, which are face-centered cubic. And then the orange ones are hexagonal closed packing lattice. And then the green ones are the diamond lattice. So the first thing we need to explain is this table. So why do we have this? Now, there are some little intuitions. For example, these guys here on this column, the electronic structure of these elements are closed shell. So there's no extra electrons. So you can think of them as being balls for all practical purposes. So you want to put balls together, that's closed packing problem, right? The sphere packing problem. So it's not a surprise to see that we have the solutions, two solutions to the closed packing problem here. One is FCC, one is HCP. Okay? But why do we get, for these column here, which are atoms, which are the most active atoms, they have one extra, one valence electron at the outermost shell. These are the chemically most active atoms, metals mostly. Why do they like BCC? So this is something that's not understood, not an even intuition. So the mathematical progress on this problem is also quite limited. So here is the question stated again. Suppose we're given some sort of atomistic potential like this. Okay. Of course, we can pose the quantum mechanics, quantum model also, but let's not do that yet. Let's just look at the classical model. You have these atomistic model like that. We ask, what is the global minimizer of this model? Until recently, there's only one result, which is by Radin, and he treated this as a, just like sphere packing problem, as a discrete geometry problem, and he proved it for a special class of potentials, like piecewise linear potentials, in two dimensions, that the triangular lattice gives the minimizer. Okay, so triangular lattice in two dimensions is like the FCC closed packing lattice in three dimensions. So this, as I said, was treated as a discrete geometry problem. Now, recently there's a paper by Florent Tile. The significance of that paper is that they transformed this discrete geometry problem into an analysis problem. The actual result he proved is that he considered a class of Lennard-Jones type of potential, like the 12-6 potential I showed earlier. He considered potentials which are qualitative like that and proved for that class of potentials the triangular lattice is indeed the the global minimizer for that class of potentials. And my student Dong Li in his thesis extended that result to a class of Sturlinger-Weber potentials. Sturlinger-Weber potentials are potentials which not only have these pairwise interactions but also have angles controlled. So he showed that for these class of potentials, the 2D hexagonal lattice and the 3D diamond lattice are the global minimizers. Okay? Now, the bottom line of this, in these proofs, there are sort of two steps. The first is a local rigidity result, saying that, well, for a global minimizer, the local structure has to be right. Okay? And secondly, yeah? Yes, there's an angular dependence of potential. Yes, otherwise you wouldn't get that. So the second step is to go from a local rigidity result to a global result. So this is very much like in the spirit of Fritz-Jahn's result in the 60s. Fritz-Jahn proved that if you have some sort of transformation which is locally close to a rotation, then it's globally close to a rotation. It's a very strong result. Okay, so this is sort of the main ingredient that goes into the proof of this. I mention this because, first of all, this is about the only global minimizer problem that we have to think about in this business. So this is one message I want to convey. This is not a concept. This is not universally agreed upon by people working in this area. And secondly, there are not that many results in this direction. Because quantum models, there are only like one-dimensional results, so not very much. Yeah, right, there are results for the quantum models, but only one dimension. In one dimension, this problem is very different. There's no geometry in one dimension. So here I'm only thinking about two and higher. So that's the first order of business. We have to figure out what is the crystal structure, because everything else depends on that. The second order of business is to understand elasticity. Where does elasticity come from? And then, ideally, we will try to understand how these defects come into play, and et cetera. So in the end, everything is in order, we would try to understand plasticity from first principles. So this would be like the long-term kind of objective. But, of course, it's very long-term. Plasticity is as bad as turbulence, so you get an idea of the level of difficulty. So now let me turn to the second problem, namely the origin of the origin of elasticity. So where do we get elastic models like that? So this, a typical model in non-elasticity would be like this. This is a variational problem. Yes, we use this now. The variational problem where F is the applied force and V is the displacement, displacement. So in this model, everything depends on W, which is tells you the property of the material, like the equation of state for gases. And it's called stored energy density. So the question is, where does W come from? Right? Well, if you look at the literature, there are three things. There's this Cauchy-Born thing, which I'm going to explain next. But the two other things are, one is linear elasticity, for which case this would be a quadratic form. And the second case would be, you know, things that are pretty much cooked up. You know, there are different ways to manufacture these kind of functions. So now the question we want to ask is, can we get this from a more microscopic, like animistic model? And this question was studied by Cauchy, to be honest. And Cauchy and then Born proposed the following recipe, namely, to define this W, first of all, W is a function of a little 3x3 matrix, because V is a vector field, so this gradient of V is a 3x3 little matrix, right? So W, think of it as a functional matrix. So the Cauchy-Born recipe says the following. You take your ideal crystal, undeformed, and you deform the crystal according to the matrix A. So given the matrix A, you want to compute W of A. So take the matrix A, you deform the crystal uniformly so that the deformation gradient is A. So maybe I should draw a little picture here. This picture is a one dimension, but maybe, so suppose you started with this ideal crystal and you do this. So that Y is equal to X plus AX. So this is still a uniform lattice. And then since you know the atomistic model, if you know the atoms, where the atoms are, you can compute from the atomistic model the energy of a unit cell. Now that energy is supposed to be the function W of A. So this is the Cauchy-Born rule. In one dimension, it's illustrated here. Actually, the contribution of Born is the following, that not all lattices are simple lattices. So what I draw here is a simple lattice. For example, diamond lattice is not a simple lattice. In that case, you need to do something extra. That's the contribution of Born. That's why these circles are there. Anyway, that's not important. So if you apply the Cauchy-Born kind of thing, you would get elastic, you know, the W functions that look like these. This is a two-dimensional triangular lattice using the Leonard Jones potential. Henry? If you have a lattice whose every point is generated from, for example, in two dimensions, if every point is generated from L1, B1, plus L2, B2 with this basis, this will be a simple lattice. If there are atoms, extra atoms that cannot be generated from this way, that's called complex lattice. For example, this is a simple lattice, that would be a basis, this is the basis. But if you consider a hexagonal lattice, that would not be simple. You cannot generate every atom by doing this. So there will be extra atoms.
I disagree.
You disagree.
You need your basis to be orthogonal?
No.
You think? But I agree that a non-simple lattice would be one of different character of atoms are on different spots. Like you face center.
Yeah. Phase center is still...
Then your other side is awesome.
Okay, so maybe I didn't say it. So triangular lattice is also a simple lattice, but this guy is not. So this guy, you cannot generate every atom by... Yeah, so what you could do is that you could take this basis, so this will be... So this sublattice is okay, because this will be one basis, this is one basis, but this guy in the middle is missed. Okay? So this will be a complex lattice. No, anyway, so is this recipe the right one? So a few years ago, this was a bit of a controversy. There were two papers which presented rather different pictures. The first paper is physical tile, same tile I mentioned before. What they did is they constructed something which looked like counterexamples to the Cauchy-Born. They showed something which is not consistent with Cauchy-Born. Okay, and the second paper is this paper by Blanc, Claude Labrie, and Pierre-Louis Lyons, where they say the following. So let's take this atomistic model. Not only the classical atomistic model, they also consider some, you know, simple versions of quantum mechanics models, which I'll mention later. And they say, okay, let's assume that the formation of the atoms is smooth, follows a smooth function, U, and let's just calculate, you know, then this thing looks like a Riemann sum, because we had a huge sum. So Riemann sum converges to the integral, and the leading order integral is the Cauchy bound, exactly the Cauchy bound. So this looks like there's no condition, so bit of a problem here. So I want to explain this apparent controversy for several. In order to do that, let me now make the following point. I want to say that if you want to, the point I want to make is the following. If you want to analyze, understand elastic states, you have to be happy with local minimizers. And here's why. Suppose we have a little chain with six atoms here, and this is the ideal state, rest state, and suppose we deform such that it would take this atom to here. The elastically deformed state would be like this. If you calculate the energy of this state, you find that, you know, the energy is n times the energy of each bond. And on the other hand, you can just break the bond, in which case the only unhappy bond is would be this. This is broken. But since all these atomistic models we have, as distance goes to infinity, the energy goes to zero. So therefore, this state actually has less energy than this state. So what I'm saying here is very simple. Namely, if you take any solid, you stretch it. As a matter of fact, the preferred state is the broken state, is the fractured state. And the reason we still have things holding together is because the barrier of going to the broken state is actually tremendously high. But mathematically, it says that we have to be happy with local minimizers, because this guy is a local minimizer. If you want this to make sense, it has to be a local minimizer. So this is the point that the global minimizer, the first problem I talk about, the crystallization problem, is a global minimizer problem. But start from that point on, we have to think about local minimizers.
The mechanical local minimizers are not stable. But the mechanical local minimizer is not stable, so within very long time.
You think about dynamics.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, that's something else.
That's
something else. So the point I want to make is that this problem here, the validity of Cauchy-Bohm is a matter of stability. Namely, the elastically deformed crystals, are they stable or not? If they're stable, then Cauchy-Bohm is valid. If they're not stable, of course, you cannot even talk about Cauchy-Bohm. And before I explain that result, in particular the stability condition, let me just say, you know, how do we address this apparent controversy between the between the physical tile result and the Blanc, Labrie, and Lyons result. Now, the physical tile result gives the apparent counterexample only because they were considering global minimizers. Actually, it's a very interesting result from analysis viewpoint, but it does not invalidate Cauchy-Bohm because they were always thinking about global minimizers. As I said earlier, you really have to think about local minimizers. The Labrie-Lyons result is a bit may actually suggest the validity of the Cauchy-Bohm when the lattice is unstable. For example, if you go back to the Leonard-Jones potential, if we just take the triangular lattice, okay, Cauchy-Bohm, everything's fine. But if we take the square lattice, if you just take the square lattice, then from this result, you know, everything is fine. It doesn't distinguish anything, the difference between the triangle and square lattice. But if you have a problem, if you consider next nearest neighbor interaction, it's a simple calculation to show that the shear modulus is negative. So in this sense, the Cauchy-Bohm problem is ill-posed. If you take the Cauchy-Bohm, you look at the minimization problem, that's ill-posed. So it doesn't make sense. You know, Cauchy-Bohm certainly is not valid. So what is this stability condition? In the physics literature, there are two kinds of stability conditions. One is the Born criteria, which says something about elastic stiffness tensor, elastic moduli, something like that. It has to be positive definite. And the second criteria is called the Lindemann criteria, which is about when the crystal melts. You know, this is something about the displacement of the atoms in the crystal. It turns out both conditions are necessary. As a matter of fact, there has been a rather has been a controversy of, you know, why there are these two different kinds of criterions. There has been some debate about, you know, which one is supposed to be the right one. So the conclusion is that both are needed. They talk about different things. So the first stability condition we need is the Born criteria, namely that this elastic stiffness tensor has to be positive definite. The second condition, which is related to the Lindemann condition, which is about the lattice itself has to be formulated in terms of phonons. So let me explain a little bit what phonons mean. So phonons are just lattice waves. If you look at a one-dimensional vibration lattice, so this is a simple equation here, you linearize this equation at a uniform state. Okay, you get some dispersion relation, and these are the dispersion relations for the lattice vibrations, and the lattice vibrations are phonons. And the picture looks like this. So you would get a phonon picture looking like that. In this simple example, this is a simple lattice. There's no extra atoms. So you only get one kind of phonons, which are called acoustic phonons. And these are phonons that look like these guys. Okay? Now, if you have a lattice like the hexagonal lattice, which would be a complex lattice, then you also have a different class of phonons, which are called optic phonons, which are these guys. So basically, acoustic phonons are the phonons of the lattice. The lattice itself is doing something. Optical phonons are the, you know, relative motion between the atoms inside the lattice. So as I told earlier, so these atoms are divided into two groups. One is this lattice, and the other is the extra atoms. They may move relative to each other, and that kind of movement is the optical phonons. So in general, that's a general picture. If you have a very complicated lattice, like three-dimensional diamond lattice, you would also get, you know, some acoustic phonons, some optic phonons. The stability condition is such that the acoustic phonons is drawn here. The acoustic phonons has to come out here, you know, the slope here has to be positive. So this, and this guy has to stay on top. You cannot come down and touch zero. So these are the two stability conditions, which are sort of like the like Lindemann criteria at zero temperature. Remember, I'm talking about zero temperature, the temperature here. So these are the second stability condition, which are conditions in terms of the lattice vibrations. Now, under these stability conditions, first of all, variational problem with Cauchy-Born stored energy functional, so this is sort of a non-elasticity problem, it's trivial and standard to prove that everything is fine. Namely, the solution is unique, there's a local, nice local minimizer. So this is, it has the typical regularity. So this is a simple thing. This is a state, classical kind of thing. But the more interesting part is that if you, under these stability conditions, and if in addition the potential is finite range, I think this is a technical condition, then the atomistic model, the original atomistic model, also has a local minimizer, which is close to the minimizer that you obtain from the non-inelasticity problem with the Cauchy-Born rule. So this validates that as long as the crystal is stable, Cauchy-Born is valid. Of course, the next question is, what happens when the crystal becomes unstable? Okay, so then you would expect that either defects will be formed or the crystal itself changes the structure into another different crystal structure. So there's research going on about trying to analyze what kind of defects will be formed or what kind of new crystal structure will be formed by looking at the stability, you know, stability boundary and the nonlinear regime. But I'm not going to get into that. Instead, let me just show one some sort of a simple applications of this kind of idea. Before I was talking about the bulk structure. Suppose you have something like a sheet or plates or rods, these sort of like curved low-dimensional structure. For example, this is a carbon nanotube. You can generalize the Cauchy-Born kind of a recipe to something which handles these cases also. So this is a carbon nanotube, which is compressed. And this is the atomistic simulation with Stinger-Weber potential. This is a Tersov potential. And this is a continuum model. So you can reproduce the atomistic features by using continuum models generated by the local Cauchy-Born rule, which is the analog of the Cauchy-Born rule for these kind of structures. So the difference is that you have to take into account curvature effects. So So now let me talk about electronic structure. I think I spent too much time on this classical part. So why is the electron, so far I have not talked about electrons. So why is electrons important? Take water. Water is, you know, considered to be a rather simple liquid, but at a microscopic level, water is very complicated. For example, water, when it freezes, it actually expands. This is quite astonishing, right? And that's because there's a network of hydrogen bonds. So these are water molecules. So there's a network of hydrogen bonds that are formed inside water, and they play a big role. And if you want to think of water, usually when we think of water as like irrigation, I mean, it doesn't really matter, but if you think of water as being the solvent for proteins, you really have to understand these hydrogen bonds. Hydrogen bonds, to a large extent, makes proteins stable. Another example, which is more relevant to my talk, we know, so these two crystal structures, this is actually, talk about two different materials. One is aluminum, one is silicon. We know these two behave very differently, right? Aluminum is a conductor, it's a metal, a silicon is a semiconductor, and one is, aluminum is very ductile. You can take aluminum, you know, you bend it back and forth, it doesn't break. You have to work very hard in order to break it. You take a silicon wafer, you put it, you let it fall, it shatters into pieces. It's a very fragile, very brittle material. Okay? And silicon, another way to look at it, silicon has a diamond lattice. Silicon, the lattice structure for silicon is usually a diamond lattice, whereas aluminum is a FCC lattice. So there are different things. We can talk about the dislocation structures are different. Many, many features of silicon and aluminum are different. Okay, you can ask why. Why are they so different? And the bottom line is that the electronic structures of these two materials are different. If you look at how electrons are distributed in aluminum, it's very isotropic, smooth distributed, which I actually show a picture later. If you look at how the electronic structure is distributed in the silicon, it's very peaked and very anisotropic. So the bottom line is that is in the electronic structure. So understanding electronic structure is sort of the heart of the matter. So now we need to have some models for electronic structure. The first principle model would be a quantum many-body problem, which we would have a wave function, huge wave function, it's a function of the coordinates over the electrons. If you have 10 to the 30 electrons, this would be a function of 10 to the 30 variables. And you write down the quantum many-body problem, you write down the total energy, so not necessary to look at this model in detail. The point being that this system is really a first principle model. There's no parameter in here. There's no artificial parameter here. Everything is, you know, the parameters here are charges of the nuclei and the position of the nuclei. You know, there is no parameter here, but there's not that much one can do about this model. Actually, mathematics, there's a lot of work, mathematical work about this, but in applications, this is a very difficult problem model to use. So the most popular model by far is the Kong-Sham DFT. So this is the one I concentrated on. The Kong-Sham DFT model, this is the thing that got Kong Nobel Prize 10 years ago, is a dramatic simplification of the previous model. So now, if we have n electrons, usually we only think about valence electrons the outermost shell. If you have n of these electrons, then the model gives you n wave functions. So these are functions of three variables now. Before we had a function of three n variables. One function, three n variables. Now we have n functions, three variables. So, but if you have a 10 to the 30 electrons, you have to have 10 to the 30 functions. Still complicated. And the energy is given by the following expression. This is the kinetic energy. This is the Coulomb interaction. Rho is the density of the electrons, defined this way. Epsilon is some atomic scale, like lattice constant. The mysterious part is this part. This is the leftover, due to the fact we have made approximations to get to this stage. And this is called, there are two parts we have forgotten. One is exchange, one is correlation. You know, never mind what these things are. So these have to be approximated. So this is not a first principle model. We have to make approximations in this model. In the simplest situation, you just assume these guys to be a function of rho. Rho to the four-thirds. Yeah, rho to the four-thirds, for example. Just a simple function of rho.
Where is the attraction term to the nuclei?
Pardon me?
Attraction to the
That's coming up next. So input to this model, the input to this model is this function m. M tells you the nuclei. So m is given this way. Here we have the yj is the position of the nuclei, and mj is the function that describes what kind of atoms you have, what kind of nucleus you have. So these are called solar potentials. So this is the input. If you want to study solids, you say, okay, yj and aj describes a deformed lattice with some defects. So yj will be the position of the atoms, and mj will be what kind of atoms you have. So this is the Kohn-Sham model, which is, works really very successfully, but there are also simplified models, tight binding model, which I'm not going to talk about. Thomas Fermi, I mentioned a little bit, hydrofoil. But let me try to understand this Kohn-Sham DFT model a little bit better. What are the main features, both from the sort of a practical and from a theoretical viewpoint? I mean, from obviously, there's this long-range Coulomb interaction, which from a practical viewpoint could be a nuisance. Right? So that's one thing. And that's already, if you want to understand that, if you just want to understand what this long-range interaction do, you can do quite well by looking at much simplified models, which are Thomas Fermi type of models. So Thomas Fermi models has no orbitals, just the density of electrons, and approximate these other terms of the energy functional by this way. Okay, why there's derivation of this, heuristic derivation of this, which I'll skip. And there's lots of mathematics done about this. You know, Thomas Fermi, and then if you take this term, it's called Thomas Fermi-Weizsäcker model. So there's a lot of very good mathematics done about this. But on the other hand, this model has a problem. It's quite inaccurate. Absolutely nobody uses in applications. For one thing, if you didn't have this term. Pardon me? If the periodic table was infinite, you actually show that it's asymptotically correct, right? This is actually asymptotically for huge atoms is actually accurate. This is Leib's result.
I just have a problem.
Yeah.
Your Coulomb term is opposed to definite.
Maybe the sign is wrong. Don't take that too seriously.
No, but you have electron-electron interaction, which are opposed to definite, and you have an electron-nuclear interaction, which are negative.
Mm-hmm.
So you have two signs.
Yeah, so if you expand this, the rho interaction will be positive, but the rho-m interaction will be negative.
Right, but if epsilon is positive, you have a...
Epsilon is positive, of course. Epsilon, that's constant.
You have a positive definite term, and that's not the case in the...
What are you saying? I mean, the Coulomb repulsing is positive, right? The attraction is negative.
Right.
That's the negative. Rho times m is negative. Rho times rho is positive. Oh, don't think about total. I mean, there could be the abstract, some constant which is
okay.
Right. Don't think. Yeah. Now we're only interested in electrons. It's a good problem to think about atoms too. But okay, if we didn't have this term, there would be no. One can show this is a theorem due to Edward Teller actually saying that there is no molecules. The atoms just fly apart. So this is not a very accurate model. But more importantly. If you think of mathematically, this model does not have orbitals. And you'll see that orbitals make a big deal. So how do we think about orbitals? The usual way to think about orbitals, so the Kohn-Sham DFT, is to write down the Euler-Lagrange equation. The Euler-Lagrange equation looks like this, which, you know, is an eigenvalue problem. Quantum mechanics, of course, it's an eigenvalue problem. But this is a system of eigenvalues, right? We're not looking at one function, we look at many functions. What I'm saying. There's something. Okay, so it's really a nonlinear system of eigenvalues. So that's the usual way to look at the problem, as a system of nonlinear eigenvalue problem. But I want to look at the problem differently. Let's put all these these orbitals together and make a little matrix, psi, where these, looks like vectors. But if you think of these as vectors, then it will be a little matrix. But anyway, let's define psi this way. The functional could also be written in the following form, where this Hamiltonian operator is different, a little bit different from the previous operator, this operator here. This term is a little bit different. but has a similar form. You can check, it's a direct calculation to show that the energy can be written in this way, can also be written in this way. So this, it's obvious from this that if you have, that this energy function is invariant on orthogonal transformation. Just obvious. Okay, so therefore, but more than that, we can even define, extend this. By the way, I forgot to mention that the orbitals were supposed to be orthonormal. I wrote down the transparencies. The orbitals are supposed to be orthonormal. This is like a Pauli's exclusion principle. That's why we get this. That's why I was unhappy about writing this way. Okay, so the psi's have to be orthonormal. Okay, so far we've only discussed orthonormal situation, but we can extend this formulation to non-orthogonal precise. As a matter of fact, all you have to do is to add this matrix inverse of the mass matrix. Okay, then this is the equivalent extension of this. In this case, it's straightforward to check that this functional is invariant under any non-singular linear transformation. Okay, if phi is a solution and L is non-singular linear transformation, phi times L is still a solution. Which means we're not looking for any kind of a solution of orbitals per se, we're looking for a subspace, the space, sort of eigen subspace, which is the space occupied by the electrons. So an eigenvalue problem and an eigen subspace problem is very different. So let me just illustrate with a very simple model. This is let's look at one-dimensional Laplace operator periodic boundary condition, and look at the eigen subspace corresponding to the smallest eigenvalues, smallest n eigenvalues. So this subspace is a space of trigonometric polynomials. Right? Very simple. Okay. So now we ask, how do we represent the subspace? If you have a problem for which your solution is actually this subspace, you can choose your representation at will, right? Well, we can represent, we just need to find a basis. We can use this as a basis. This will be the end of a block function. But for this problem, you can also check very simply that if you take Dn to be a Dirichlet kernel and translates on an equally spaced point, this is still, this is also a basis. And these are in connection with the quantum mechanics, these are the analogs of Bernier functions, so-called Bernier functions. Now, the advantage of these Bernier functions is that they're localized. For example, this is a plot of the Dirichlet kernel. You can see that it's peaked and then decays. Now you can ask, well, can we get better ones? Can we make something where that decays even faster? Well, if you look at the Fourier kernel, it actually decays faster. So I don't know which one is which. But this guy is the Dirichlet. This guy is a Dirichlet. The blue line, which you don't see, I don't think you can see the blue line, is this, is the Fourier. And you might ask, well, if you go this Cesario thing, you know, maybe the next one is even better. Actually, no. The next one is worse. But in any case, one can develop a theory which tells you what kind of, you know, how do you find more and more localized, decay faster and faster basis functions. Okay, so let me skip this because I'm running out of time. So, but maybe mention one thing that this is, from a practical viewpoint, this can be useful, because there are many situations we want to have, we have the following problem. We have a huge matrix, and we want to reduce that huge matrix to a small matrix, right? This is a typical model reduction problem. And usually one would do like SVD. SVD are like the computing eigenvalues. Okay, if you do SVD, the reduced matrix is diagonal, very localized. But the basis representation of eigenfunctions were typically not localized at all. So you want to make a compromise so that the compressed operator and the basis functions are both sort of approximately localized. This is the way to go. This kind of thing would give you a compressed operator which is approximately localized, not diagonal, but still quite localized, and these basis functions themselves would be localized too. In the case of Kunshan, that's how it looks like. So now I want to ask a question. How do we go from these kind of quantum mechanics models to the elasticity model I was talking about earlier? Okay? To answer this question, let me first show you formally how this thing works. So I need some annotations here. I need to make an ansatz, right? But if I want to make an ansatz, then there's a problem here, which is this conflict of coordinates. Namely, when I think about elasticity, I already mentioned it early on, elasticity is usually expressed in terms of Lagrangian coordinates. But electronic structures, the quantum mechanics models, are expressed in terms of Eulerian coordinates. So there's some conflicts in that regard. But that could be overcome, that could be handled. So let's look at this formally. So let's assume that the displacement of the atoms follows a smooth function. So this is like Blanc, Labrie, and Lyons was doing. Let's make that assumption. Later on, we can ask whether this assumption is correct. In that case, it turns out the right ansatz is the following. So these are the orbitals. We have a situation for which we have many, many, more and more, as epsilon goes to zero, we have more and more atoms and more electrons, which means we have more and more of these orbitals. The number of orbitals goes to infinity. And what you have in mind is that around each electron, there is an orbital of this type. And these orbitals behave like this. So this is the slow variable here, and this is the fast variable, which will be describing the internal structure of these orbitals. But the density itself also have this following structure. The right ansatz is that these things, when some of you are probably familiar with homogenization problems, in which case this variable is supposed to be periodic. Right? If you look at a structure like that, that would motivate assuming this being periodic. And that's correct.
So that's an ansatz.
I'm just trying to show you the formal calculation right now. So that's the correct assumption. But for the orbitals, you need to assume that this has been decaying. So the picture you have in mind is that you have lots of these decaying, peaked and decaying, like Gaussian type of functions, centered at the atoms. If you have one electron, there's one of these functions. And these functions are slowly varying, but each one looks like a Gaussian. That's sort of the picture. And once you formulate the ansatz, you plug it into, you do the standard thing, and this will be the leading order equation. And those look like a mess. But the thing here is that this is only a function, a differential equation in the fast variable z. Okay, these other things with the slow variables comes in because the coefficients, these Laplacians, have changed. The Laplacians are defined this way. Okay, so there is this coefficient here which depend on slow variables. But they only enter as a parameters. This is an equation in terms of fast variable only. So that's rather dramatic. If you look at higher order terms, the structure is always like that. So this is actually different from the standard homogenization problem. In the standard homogenization problem, there's a solvability condition which gives you something about the slow variables. Here, no. Look, every order, the equation is always only in the fast variables. And that's saying that the slow variables enter only as source terms. So this problem is totally local. The electron structure here, the electron structure is totally local. It's almost independent of each other. You solve one equation here, solve another equation here. And that, at the first sight, might be quite surprising because quantum mechanics itself is very non-local. It's an eigenmatter problem. Eigenmatter's problems are pretty non-local. And has these Coulomb interactions. And then the Pauli exclusion principle is also non-local because the Pauli exclusion principle is in the form of orthogonality conditions of the orbitals. That's also a non-local thing. But the asymptotic suggests that it's very local. And this is suggested by the papers of, if you look at the papers of Walter Kohn in early, very early time, he said something about, he coined this notion of nearsightedness, which is to large effect saying what I just said, that there's actually locality in this quantum mechanics problem. So I just said, this is just a formal. So now let's ask the question, whether this asymptotic, whether this is kind of a formal analysis is actually rigorous. Now, there's no way to prove any kind of a general theorem because we can easily construct counterexamples. If you just consider general solutions to the Kohn-Sham problem, you can construct counterexamples which is not consistent with the ansatz. So we have to be happy with a slightly weaker theorem, a much weaker theorem, saying, are there special solutions which are close to my ansatz? In some sense, this is the spirit of the theorem as I just stated earlier. For that purpose, we need a third stability condition, which is the stability condition at the level of electrons. And the third stability condition is saying that the band gap, which I didn't explain what the band gap, has to be uniformly bounded from below. So we can, which means that the system has to be uniformly insulating. Metals will not be good. Under this condition, then. Pardon me?
Uniformly,
uniformly in locations, right? Because I have these deformations which are smooth, but each place I have these local, I have a band gap problem. I solve, at each macroscopic location there's a band gap problem. And that band gap has to be uniformly bounded from zero. If this is not true, then the theorem doesn't work. Okay, but if this is true, then you can show that you can there exist solutions to the original Kunshan problem which are close to the ones that we just constructed. Okay, so putting all things together, the whole thing is about stability of crystals. We have three stability conditions. One is the continuum level, this is the Born condition. The other is the second stability condition is the phonons, that's the stability at the level of the atomic lattice. And then we have also a stability condition at the level of the electronic structure, which is the formula in terms of band gap, band structure. So the question is, what happened to metals? Metals clearly exist, but somehow is not explained by this theory. So this is still very much of a mystery. Now, I only talk about some theory, but you know these things can be they're useful in terms of applications. And in particular, we've used this idea to construct what is called sublinear scaling algorithms for doing Kunshan DFT. So numerical algorithms for Kunshan DFT is a big business. So if you for solids, you can use the ideas that I just presented, the asymptotic analysis, to construct what is called sublinear scaling algorithms. That sounds too good to be true. It says that the total cost is less than the number of atoms asymptotically, you know, scaling. And you can also use this to analyze. If you want to construct, this is sort of a typical multiscalability thing, if you want to construct a model which is quantum mechanics here, classical mechanics here, you want to make sure the two matches without any creating any extra error in the boundary, you can use this kind of analysis to show that. Many things need to be done, so crystallization problem is still very far. I didn't talk about the defect, there are a lot of things about defects we don't understand. The finite temperature was is a big problem, and of course dynamics is a big problem. Okay, I'll end with this thing here. So in terms of the multiscale modeling, big picture of multiscale modeling, what I talked about is this box here. Okay, so we know every system can be described by a hierarchy of models. So for gas, for example, we talk about gas dynamics models, kinetic theory, liquids, you know, hydrodynamic, Navier-Stokes, molecular dynamics, etc. And solids, there's, you know, different kinds of models in solids. If you want to do multiscale modeling in a serious way, you have to understand the connection between each one of these models, different hierarchy of models. I only spoke about this part here today. And you can see that even this part is not all understood. And, you know, filling up all the gaps, well, actually some are pretty well understood, you know, in the mathematical literature. But most of these are still open. So filling out this table is what really needs to be done if we want to talk about multiscale modeling seriously. Well, thank you very much.